and the girl was on him once again. Tyrion rolled to one side as she buried the knife blade in the floorboards, yanked it free, raised it again. And suddenly she was rising off the floor, legs kicking wildly as she struggled in Ser Jorah's grasp.
"No," she wailed in the common tongue of Westeros. "Let go!"
Tyrion heard her tunic rip as she fought to free herself. Mormont had her by the collar with one hand. With the other, he wrenched the dagger from her grasp. "Enough!" The landlord made his appearance then, a cudgel in his hand, but when he saw the broken flagon, he uttered a blistering curse and demanded to know what had happened here. "Dwarf fight," replied the Tyrushi with a purple beard, chuckling. Tyrion blinked up at the dripping girl twisting in the air. "Why?" he demanded. "What did I ever do to you?"
"They killed him."
All the fight went out of her at that. She hung limply in Mormon's grasp as her eyes filled with tears.
"My brother, they took him, and they killed him."
"Who killed him?" asked Mormont.
"Sailors. Sailors from the Seven Kingdoms. There were five of them, drunk. They saw us jousting in the square and followed us. When they realized I was a girl, they let me go, but they took my brother and killed him. They cut his head off."
Tyrion felt a sudden shock of recognition. "They saw us jousting in the square? He knew who the girl was, then."
"Did you ride the pig," he asked her, "or the dog?" "The dog," she sobbed. "Uppo always rode the pig."
"The dwarfs from Joffrey's wedding. It was their show that had started all the trouble that night. How strange to encounter them again, half a world away, though perhaps not so strange as that. If they'd had half the wits of their pig, they would have fled King's Landing the night Joff died, before Cersei could assign them some share of blame in her son's death." "Let her down, sir," he told Ser Jorah Mormont. "She won't do us any harm." Ser Jorah dumped the dwarf girl on the floor. "I'm sorry for your brother, but we had no part in his murder."
"He did."
The girl pushed herself to her knees, clutching her torn, wine-drenched tunic to small, pale breasts.
"It was him they wanted. They thought Uppo was him."
The girl was weeping, begging for help from anyone who would listen.
"He should die, the way my poor brother died. Please, someone help me. Someone kill him."
The landlord seized her roughly by one arm and wrenched her back to her feet, shouting in Volantine, demanding to know who was going to pay for this damage. The widow of the waterfront gave Mormont a cool look.
"Knights defend the weak and protect the innocent, they say. And I am the fairest maid in all Valantis."
Her laugh was full of scorn.
"What do they call you, child?"
"Penny."
The old woman called out to the landlord in the tongue of old Valantis. Tyrion knew enough to understand that she was telling him to take the dwarf girl up to her rooms, give her wine, and find some clothes for her to wear. When they were gone, the widow studied Tyrion, her black eyes shining.
"Monsters should be larger, it seems to me. You're worth a lordship back in Westeros, little man. Here, I fear, your worth is somewhat less. But I think I'd best help you after all. Valantis is no safe place for dwarfs, it seems."
"You are too kind." Tyrion gave her his sweetest smile. "Perhaps you would be so kind as to remove these charming iron bracelets as well. This monster has but half a nose, and it itches most abominably. The chains are too short for me to scratch it. I'll make you a gift of them, and gladly."
"How generous! But I have worn iron in my time, and now I find that I prefer gold and silver. And sad to say, this is Valantis, where fetters and chains are cheaper than day-old bread, and it is forbidden to help a slave escape." I'm no slave.
Oh, every man ever taken by slavers sings that same sad song. I dare not help you. Here.
She leaned forward again.
2 days from now, the cog, Salisori Corran, will set sail for Cork by way of New Gith, carrying tin and iron, bales of wool and lace, 50 Mearish carpets, a corpse pickled in brine, 20 jars of dragon peppers, and a red priest. Be on her when she sails.
We will, said Tyrion, and thank you. Sir Jorah frowned.
Carth is not our destination. She will never reach Carth. Benero has seen it in his fires.
The crone smiled, a vulpine smile. As you say, Tyrion grinned, if I were Valentine and free and had the blood, you'd have my vote for Treyarch, my lady.
I'm no lady, the widow replied, just Volgaro's whore. You want to be gone from here before the tigers come. Should you reach your queen, give her a message from the slaves of old Valentis.
She touched the faded scar upon her wrinkled cheek, where her tears had been cut away.
Tell her we are waiting. Tell her to come soon.
Bran. Mira moved in a wary circle, her net dangling loose in her left hand, the slender three-pronged frog spear poised in her right. Summer followed her with his golden eyes, turning, his tail held stiff and tall, watching, watching. Yaish! The girl shouted, the spear darting out. The wolf slid to his left and leapt before she could draw back the spear. Mira cast her net, the tangles unfolding in the air before her. Summer's leap carried him into it. He dragged it with him as he slammed into her chest and knocked her over backward. Her spear went spinning away. The damp grass cushioned her fall, but the breath went out of her with a whoosh. The wolf crouched atop her. Bran hooted. You lose. She wins, her brother Jojen said. Summer snared. He was right, Bran saw. Thrashing and growling at the net, trying to rip free, Summer was only ensnaring himself worse. Nor could he bite through. Let him out. Laughing, the reed girl threw her arms around the tangled wolf and rolled them both. Summer gave a piteous whine, his legs kicking against the cords that bound them. Mira knelt, undid a twist, pulled at a corner, tugged deftly here and there, and suddenly the direwolf was bounding free. Summer, to me! Bran spread his arms. Watch, he said, an instant before the wolf bowled into him. He clung with all his strength as the wolf dragged him bumping through the grass. They wrestled and rolled and clung to each other, one snarling and yapping, the other laughing. In the end, it was Bran, sprawled on top, the mud-spattered direwolf under him. Good wolf, he panted. Summer licked him across the ear. Mira shook her head.
Does he never grow angry?
Not with me. Bran grabbed the wolf by his ears, and Summer snapped at him fiercely, but it was all in play. Sometimes he tears my garb, but he's never drawn blood. Your blood, you mean, if he'd gotten past my net. He wouldn't have hurt you. He knows I like you. All of the other lords and knights had departed within a day or two of the harvest feast, but the reeds had stayed on to become Bran's constant companions. Jojen was so solemn that old Nan called him Little Grandfather, but Mira reminded Bran of his sister, Arya. She wasn't scared to get dirty, and she could run and fight and throw as good as a boy. She was older than Arya, though, almost 16, a woman grown. They were both older than Bran, even though his ninth name day had finally come and gone, but they never treated him like a child. I wish you were our wards instead of the Walders. He began to struggle towards the nearest tree. His dragging and wriggling was unseemly to watch, but when Mira moved to lift him, he said, No, Don't help me." He rolled clumsily and pushed and squirmed backwards, using the strength of his arms, until he was sitting with his back to the trunk of a tall ash. "See, I told you." Summer lay down with his head in Bran's lap. "I never knew anyone who fought with a net before," he told Mira, while he scratched the dire wolf between the ears. "Did your master-at-arms teach you net fighting?"
"My father taught me. We have no knights at Greywater, no master-at-arms, and no maester."
"Who keeps your ravens?" She smiled.
"Ravens can't find Greywater Watch no more than our enemies can."
"Why not?"
"Because it moves," she told him.
Bran had never heard of a moving castle before. He looked at her uncertainly, but he couldn't tell whether she was teasing him or not. "I wish I could see it. Do you think your Lord Father would let me come visit when the war is over?"
"You would be most welcome, my prince, then or now."
"Now?" Bran had spent his whole life at Winterfell. He yearned to see far places. "I can ask Sir Roderick when he returns." The old knight was off east, trying to set to rights the trouble there. Roose Bolton's bastard had started it by seizing Lady Hornwood as she returned from the harvest feast, marrying her that very night, even though he was young enough to be her son. Then Lord Manderly had taken her castle. "To protect the Hornwood holdings from the Boltons," he had written. But Sir Roderick had been almost as angry with him as with the bastard. "Sir Roderick might let me go. Maester Lewin never would." Sitting cross-legged under the weir tree, Jojen Reed regarded him solemnly.
"It would be good if you left Winterfell, Bran."
"It would?"
"Yes, and sooner rather than later." "My brother has the green sight," said Mira. "He dreams things that haven't happened, but sometimes they do." "There is no sometimes, Mira."
A look passed between them. Him sad, her defiant. "Tell me what's going to happen," Bran said.
"I will," said Jojen, "if you tell me about your dreams."
The guardswood grew quiet. Bran could hear leaves rustling and Hodor's distant splashing from the hot pools. He thought of the golden man and the three-eyed crow, remembered the crunch of bones between his jaws and the coppery taste of blood. "I don't have dreams. Maester Lewin gives me sleeping draughts."
"Do they help?"
"Sometimes." Mira said,
"All of Winterfell knows you wake at night, shouting and sweating, Bran. The women talk of it at the well, and the guards in their hall." "Tell us what frightened you so much," said Jojen.
"I don't want to. Anyway, it's only dreams. Maester Lewin says dreams might mean anything or nothing."
"My brother dreams, as other boys do, and those dreams might mean anything," Mira said. "But the green dreams are different."
Jojen's eyes were the colour of moss, and sometimes, when he looked at you, he seemed to be seeing something else, like now.
"I dreamed of a winged wolf, bound to earth with grey stone chains," he said. "It was a green dream, so I know it was true. A crow was trying to peck through the chains, but the stone was too hard, and his beak could only chip at them."
"Did the crow have three eyes?" Jojen nodded. Summer raised his head from Bran's lap and gazed at the mudman with his dark golden eyes.
"When I was little, I almost died of greywater fever. That was when the crow came to me."
"He came to me after I fell," Bran blurted. "I was asleep for a long time. He said I had to fly or die, and I woke up, only I was broken, and I couldn't fly after all."
"You can if you want to."
Picking up her net, Mira shook out the last tangles and began arranging it in loose folds.
"You are the winged wolf, Bran," said Jojen. "I wasn't sure when we first came, but now I am. The crow sent us here to break your chains."
"Is the crow at Greywater?"
"No, the crow is in the north."
"At the wall?" Bran had always wanted to see the wall. His bastard brother John was there now, a man of the night's watch. Beyond the wall, Mira Reed hung the net from her belt. When Jojen told our Lord Father what he'd dreamed, he sent us to Winterfell. How would I break the chains, Jojen? Bran asked.
Open your eye. They are open. Can't you see?
Two are open, Jojen pointed. One, two. I only have two.
You have three. The crow gave you the third, but you will not open it.
He had a slow, soft way of speaking.
With two eyes, you see my face. With three, you could see my heart. With two, you can see that oak tree there. With three, you could see the acorn the oak grew from, and the stump that it will one day become. With two, you can see no further than your walls. With three, you would gaze south to the summer sea and north beyond the wall.
Summer got to his feet. I don't need to see so far. Bran made a nervous smile. I'm tired of talking about crows. Let's talk about wolves or lizard lions. Have you ever hunted one, Mira? We don't have them here. Mira plucked her frog spear out of the bushes.
They live in the water, in slow streams and deep swamps.
Her brother interrupted.
Did you dream of a lizard lion?
No, said Bran. I told you, I don't want...
Did you dream of a wolf?
He was making Bran angry. I don't have to tell you my dreams. I'm the prince. I'm the Stark in Winterfell.
Was it summer?
You be quiet.
The night of the harvest feast. You dreamed you were summer in the God's Wood, didn't you?
Stop it, Bran shouted. Summer slid toward the weirwood, his white teeth bared. Jojen Reed took no mind.
When I touched Summer, I felt you in him, just as you are in him now.
You couldn't have. I was in bed. I was sleeping.
You were in the God's Wood, all in grey.
It was only a bad dream. Jojen stood.
I felt you. I felt you fall. Is that what scares you, the falling?
The falling, Bran thought. And the Golden Man, the Queen's brother. He scares me too, but mostly the falling. He did not say it, though. How could he? He had not been able to tell Sir Roderick or Maester Lewin, and he could not tell the Reeds either. If he didn't talk about it, maybe he would forget. He had never wanted to remember. It might not even be a true remembering.
Do you fall every night, Bran?
Jojen asked quietly. A low, rumbling growl rose from Summer's throat, and there was no play in it. He stalked forward, all teeth and hot eyes. Mira stepped between the wolf and her brother, spear in hand.
Keep him back, Bran.
Jojen is making him angry. Mira shook out her net.
It's your anger, Bran, her brother said. Your fear.
It isn't. I'm not a wolf. Yet he'd howled with them in the night and tasted blood in his wolf dreams.
Part of you is Summer, and part of Summer is you. You know that, Bran.
Summer rushed forward, but Mira blocked him, jabbing with a three-pronged spear. The wolf twisted aside, circling, stalking. Mira turned to face him.
Call him back, Bran.
Summer? Bran shouted. To me, Summer! He slapped an open palm down on the meat of his thigh. His hand tingled, though his dead leg felt nothing. The direwolf lunged again, and again Mira's spear darted out. Summer dodged, circling back. The bushes rustled, and a lean black shape came padding from behind the weirwood, teeth bared. The scent was strong. His brother had smelled his rage. Bran felt hairs rise on the back of his neck. Mira stood beside her brother, with wolves to either side. Bran, call them off.
I can't. Jojen, up the tree. There's no need. Today is not the day I die.
Do it, she screamed. and her brother scrambled up the trunk of the weirwood, using the face for his handholds. The direwolves closed. Mira abandoned spear, and Net jumped up and grabbed the branch above her head. Shaggy's jaw snapped shut beneath her ankle as she swung up and over the limb. Summer sat back on his haunches and howled, while Shaggy Dog worried the net, shaking it in his teeth. Only then did Bran remember that they were not alone. He cupped his hands around his mouth. "Hodor!" he shouted. "Hodor! Hodor!" He was badly frightened and somehow ashamed. "They won't hurt Hodor," he assured his treed friends. A few moments passed before they heard a tuneless humming. Hodor arrived, half-dressed and mud-spattered from his visit to the hot pools. But Bran had never been so glad to see him. "Hodor, help me. Chase off the wolves. Chase them off." Hodor went to it gleefully, waving his arms and stamping his huge feet, shouting, "Hodor! Hodor!" running first at one wolf and then the other. Shaggy Dog was the first to flee, slinking back into the foliage with a final snarl. When Summer had enough, he came back to Bran and lay down beside him. No sooner did Mira touch ground than she snatched up her spear and net again. Jojen never took his eyes off Summer.
"We will talk again," he promised Bran.
It was the wolves, it wasn't me. He did not understand why they'd gotten so wild. Maybe Maester Lewin was right to lock them in the guard's wood. "Hodor," he said, "bring me to Maester Lewin." The maester's turret below the rookery was one of Bran's favourite places. Lewin was hopelessly untidy, but his clutter of books and scrolls and bottles was as familiar and comforting to Bran as his bald spot and the flapping sleeves of his loose grey robes. He liked the ravens, too. He found Lewin perched on a high stool, writing. With Sir Roderick gone, all the governance of the castle had fallen on his shoulders.
"My prince," he said, when Hodor entered, "you're early for lessons today."
The maester spent several hours every afternoon tutoring Bran, Rickon, and the Walder Freys. "Hodor, stand still." Bran grasped a wall sconce with both hands and used it to pull himself up and out of the basket. He hung for a moment by his arms until Hodor carried him to a chair.
"Mira says her brother has the green sight."
Maester Lewin scratched at the side of his nose with his writing quill.
"Does she now?"
He nodded. "You told me that the children of the forest had the green sight, I remember."
"Some claim to have that power. Their wise men were called green seers."
"Was it magic?"
"We'll call it that, for want of a better word, if you must. At heart, it was only a different sort of knowledge."
"What was it?" Lewin set down his quill.
"No one truly knows, Bran. The children are gone from the world, and their wisdom with them. It had to do with the faces in the trees, we think. The first men believed that the green seers could see through the eyes of the weirwoods. That was why they cut down the trees whenever they warred upon the children. Supposedly, the green seers also had power over the beasts of the wood and the birds in the trees, even fish. Does the reed boy claim such powers?"
"No, I don't think. But he has dreams that come true sometimes," Mira says.
"Well, all of us have dreams that come true sometimes. You dreamed of your Lord Father in the crypts before we knew he was dead, remember?"
"Rickon did, too. We dreamed the same dream."
"Call it green sight, if you wish. But remember as well all those tens of thousands of dreams that you and Rickon have dreamed that did not come true. Do you perchance recall what I taught you about the chain collar that every maester wears?"
Bran thought for a moment, trying to remember. "A maester forges his chain in the citadel of Old Town,
It's a chain because you swear to serve, and it's made of different metals because you serve the realm, and the realm has different sorts of people. Every time you learn something, you get another link. Black iron is for ravenry, silver for healing, gold for sums and numbers. I don't remember them all. Lewin slid a finger up under his collar and began to turn it inch by inch. He had a thick neck for a small man, and the chain was tight, but a few pulls had it all the way around. "This is Valerian steel," he said, when the link of dark grey metal lay against the apple of his throat. "Only one maester in 100 wears such a link. This signifies that I have studied what the Citadel calls the higher mysteries. Magic, for want of a better word. A fascinating pursuit, but of small use, which is why so few maesters trouble themselves with it. All those who study the higher mysteries try their own hand at spells, soon or late. I yielded to the temptation, too, I must confess it, when I was a boy. And what boy does not secretly wish to find hidden powers in himself? I got no more for my efforts than 1,000 boys before me, and 1,000 since. Sad to say, magic does not work." "Sometimes it does," Bran protested. "I had that dream, and Rickon did too, and there are mages and warlocks in the East. There are men who call themselves mages and warlocks," Maester Lewin said. "I had a friend at the Citadel who could pull a rose out of your ear, but he was no more magical than I was. Oh, to be sure, there is much we do not understand. The years pass in their hundreds and their thousands, and what does any man see of life but a few summers, a few winters? We look at mountains and call them eternal, and so they seem, but in the course of time mountains rise and fall, rivers change their courses, stars fall from the sky, and great cities sink beneath the sea. Even gods die, we think. Everything changes. Perhaps magic was once a mighty force in the world, but no longer. What little remains is no more than the wisp of smoke that lingers in the air after a great fire has burned out. And even that is fading. Valyria was the last ember, and Valyria is gone. The dragons are no more. The giants are dead. The children of the forest forgotten, with all their lore. No, my prince. Jojen Reed may have had a dream or two that he believes came true, but he does not have the green sight. No living man has that power. Bran said as much to Mira Reed when she came to him at dusk, as he sat in his window seat, watching the lights flicker to life. "I'm sorry for what happened with the wolves. Summer shouldn't have tried to hurt Jojen, but Jojen shouldn't have said all that about my dreams. The crow lied when he said I could fly. And your brother lied too. Or perhaps your maester is wrong. Oh, he isn't. Even my father relied on his counsel." "Your father listened, I have no doubt, but in the end he decided for himself. Bran, will you let me tell you about a dream Jojen dreamed of you and your fustling brothers?" "The Walders aren't my brothers." She paid that no heed. "You were sitting at supper, but instead of a servant, Maester Lewin brought you your food. He served you the king's cut off the roast, the meat rare and bloody, but with a savory smell that made everyone's mouth water. The meat he served, the Freys, was old and grey and dead. Yet they liked their supper better than you like yours. I don't understand. You will, my brother says. When you do, we'll talk again." Bran was almost afraid to sit to supper that night, but when he did, it was pigeon pie they set before him. Everyone else was served the same.
and he couldn't see that anything was wrong with the food they served the Walders.
Maester Lewin has the truth of it, he told himself. Nothing bad was coming to Winterfell, no matter what Jojen said. Bran was relieved, but disappointed too. So long as there was magic, anything could happen. Ghosts could walk, trees could talk, and broken boys could grow up to be knights. But there isn't, he said aloud in the darkness of his bed. There's no magic, and the stories are just stories.
And he would never walk, nor fly, nor be a knight. Catelyn.
My lady, you ought to cover your head, Sir Roderick told her as their horses plodded north. You will take a chill.
It's only water, Sir Roderick, Catelyn replied. Her hair hung wet and heavy, a loose strand stuck to her forehead, and she could imagine how ragged and wild she must look, but for once she did not care. The southern rain was soft and warm. Catelyn liked the feel of it on her face, gentle as her mother's kisses. It took her back to her childhood, to long grey days at Riverrun. She remembered the God's Wood, drooping branches heavy with moisture, and the sound of her brother's laughter as he chased her through piles of damp leaves. She remembered making mud pies with Lysa, the weight of them, the mud slick and brown between her fingers. They had served them to Littlefinger, giggling, and he'd eaten so much mud he was sick for a week. How young they all had been. Catelyn had almost forgotten. In the north the rain fell cold and hard, and sometimes at night it turned to ice. It was as likely to kill a crop as nurture it, and it sent grown men running for the nearest shelter. That was no rain for little girls to play in.
I'm soaked through, Sir Roderick complained. Even my bones are wet.
The woods pressed close around them, and the steady pattering of rain on leaves was accompanied by the small sucking sounds the horses made as their hooves pulled free of the mud.
We will want a fire tonight, milady, and a hot meal would serve us both.
There is an inn at the crossroad up ahead, Catelyn told him. She had slept many a night there in her youth, travelling with her father. Lord Huster Tully had been a restless man in his prime, always riding somewhere. She still remembered the innkeep, a fat woman named Masha Heddle, who chewed sour leaf night and day and seemed to have an endless supply of smiles and sweet cakes for the children. The sweet cakes had been soaked with honey, rich and heavy on the tongue. But how Catelyn had dreaded those smiles! The sour leaf had stained Masha's teeth a dark red and made her smile a bloody horror.
An inn, Sir Roderick repeated wistfully. If only. But we dare not risk it. If we wish to remain unknown, I think it best we seek out some small holdfast.
He broke off as they heard sounds up the road. Splashing water, the clink of mail, a horse's whinny.
Riders, he warned, his hand dropping to the hilt of his sword. Even on the King's Road, it never hurt to be wary.
They followed the sounds around a lazy bend of the road and saw them, a column of armed men noisily fording a swollen stream. Catelyn reined up to let them pass. The banner in the hand of the foremost rider hung sodden and limp, but the guardsmen wore indigo cloaks, and on their shoulders flew the silver eagle of Seaguard.
Malisters, Sir Roderick whispered to her, as if she had not known. My lady, best pull up your hood.
Catelyn made no move. Lord Jason Malister himself rode with them, surrounded by his knights, his son Patrick by his side, and their squires close behind. They were riding for King's Landing and the hounds Tawny, she knew. For the past week the travellers had been thick as flies upon the King's Road. Knights and free riders, singers with their harps and drums, heavy wagons laden with hops or corn or casks of honey, traders and craftsmen and whores, and all of them moving south. She studied Lord Jason Boulding. The last time she had seen him, he had been jesting with her uncle at her wedding feast. The Malisters stood bannermen to the Tullys, and his gifts had been lavish. His brown hair was salted with white now, his face chiselled gaunt by time. Yet the years had not touched his pride. He rode like a man who feared nothing. Catelyn envied him that. She had come to fear so much. As the riders passed, Lord Jason nodded a curt greeting, but it was only a High Lord's courtesy to strangers chance met on the road. There was no recognition in those fierce eyes, and his son did not even waste a look.
"He did not know you," Sir Roderick said after, wondering.
He saw a pair of mud-spattered travellers by the side of the road, wet and tired. It would never occur to him to suspect that one of them was the daughter of his liege lord. "I think we shall be safe enough at the inn, Sir Roderick." It was near dark when they reached it, at the crossroads north of the great confluence of the Trident. Masha Heddle was fatter and greyer than Catelyn remembered, still chewing her sour leaf, but she gave them only the most cursory of looks, with nary hint of a ghastly red smile.
"Two rooms at the top of the stairs, that's all there is," she said, chewing all the while. "They're under the bell tower, so you won't be missing meals. Though there's some thinks it's too noisy. Can't be helped. We're full up. Or as near as makes no matter. It's those rooms or the road."
It was those rooms. Low, dusty garrets at the top of a cramped, narrow staircase.
"Leave your boots down here," Marcia told them, after she'd taken their coin. "The boy will clean them. I won't have you trekking mud up my stairs. Mind the bell. Those who come late to meals don't eat."
There were no smiles and no mention of sweet cakes. When the supper bell rang, the sound was deafening. Catelyn had changed into dry clothes. She sat by the window, watching rain run down the pane. The glass was milky and full of bubbles, and a wet dusk was falling outside. Catelyn could just make out the muddy crossing where the two great roads met. The crossroads gave her pause. If they turned west from here, it was an easy ride down to River Run. Her father had always given her wise counsel when she needed it most, and she yearned to talk to him, to warn him of the gathering storm. If Winterfell needed to brace for war, how much more so River Run, so much closer to King's Landing, with a power of Casterly Rock looming to the west like a shadow. If only her father had been stronger, she might have chanced it. But Hoster Tully had been bedridden these past 2 years, and Catelyn was loath to tax him now. The eastern road was wilder and more dangerous, climbing through rocky foothills and thick forests into the mountains of the moon, past high passes and deep chasms to the Vale of Arryn and the stony fingers beyond. Above the vale, the Eyrie stood high and impregnable, its towers reaching for the sky. There she would find her sister, and perhaps some of the answers Ned sought. Surely Lysa knew more than she had dared to put in a letter. She might have the very proof that Ned needed to bring the Lannisters to ruin, and if it came to war, they would need the Aerons and the Eastern Lords who owed them service. Yet the mountain road was perilous. Shadow cats prowled those passes, rock slides were common, and the mountain clans were lawless brigands, descending from the heights to rob and kill, and melting away like snow whenever the knights rode out from the vale in search of them. Even John Arryn, as great a lord as any the Eyrie had ever known, had always travelled in strength when he crossed the mountains. Catelyn's only strength was one elderly knight armoured in loyalty. No, she thought, River Run and the Eyrie would have to wait. Her path ran north to Winterfell, where her sons and her duty were waiting for her. As soon as they were safely past the Neck, she could declare herself to one of Ned's bannermen and send riders racing ahead with orders to mount a watch on the King's Road. The rain obscured the fields beyond the crossroads, but Catelyn saw the land clear enough in her memory. The marketplace was just across the way, and the village a mile further on, 50 white cottages surrounding a small stone sept. There would be more now. The summer had been long and peaceful. North of here, the King's Road ran along the green fork of the Trident, through fertile valleys and green woodlands, past thriving towns and stout holdfasts and the castles of the river lords. Catelyn knew them all, the Blackwoods and the Brackens, ever enemies whose quarrels her father was obliged to settle. Lady Went, last of her line, who dwelt with her ghosts in the cavernous vaults of Harrenhal. Irascible Lord Frey, who had outlived 7 wives and filled his twin castles with children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and bastards and grand-bastards as well. All of them were bannermen to the Tullys, their swords sworn to the service of Riverrun. Catelyn wondered if that would be enough, if it came to war. Her father was the staunchest man who had ever lived, and she had no doubt that he would call his banners. But would the banners come? The Darrys and Rygers and Mutons had sworn oaths to Riverrun as well, yet they had fought with Rhaegar Targaryen on the Trident, while Lord Frey had arrived with his levies well after the battle was over, leaving some doubt as to which army he had planned to join. Theirs, he had assured the victors solemnly in the aftermath, but ever after, her father had called him the late Lord Frey. It must not come to war, Catelyn thought fervently. They must not let it. Sir Roderick came for her just as the bell ceased its clangor. We'd best make haste, if we hope to eat tonight, my lady. It might be safer if we were not knight and lady until we passed the neck, she told him. Common travellers attract less notice. Her father and daughter taken to the road on some family business, say. As you say, my lady, Sir Roderick agreed. It was only when she had laughed that he realized what he'd done. The old curses die hard, my daughter. He tried to tug on his missing whiskers and sighed with exasperation. Catelyn took his arm. Come, father, she said. You'll find that Masha Heddle sets a good table, I think, but try not to praise her. You truly don't want to see her smile. The common room was long and draughty, with a row of huge wooden kegs at one end and a fireplace at the other. A serving boy ran back and forth with skewers of meat while Masha drew beer from the kegs, chewing her sour leaf all the while. The benches were crowded, townsfolk and farmers mingling freely with all manner of travellers. The crossroads made for odd companions. Dyers with black and purple hands shared a bench with rivermen reeking of fish. An ironsmith, thick with muscles, squeezed in between a wizened old septon. Hard-bitten sellswords and soft, plump merchants swapped news like boon companions. The company included more swords than Catelyn would have liked. 3 by the fire wore the red stallion badge of the Brackens, and there was a large party in blue steel ringmail and capes of silvery grey. On their shoulder was another familiar sigil, the twin towers of House Frey. She studied their faces, but they were all too young to have known her. The senior among them would have been no older than Bran when she went north. Sir Roderick found them an entry place on the bench near the kitchen. Across the table, a handsome youth was fingering a wood harp. 7 blessings to you, good folk, he said as they sat. An empty wine cup stood on the table before him. And to you, singer, Catelyn returned. Sir Roderick called for bread and meat and beer, in a tone that meant now. The singer, a youth of some 18 years, eyed them boldly and asked where they were going, and from whence they had come, and what news they had, letting the questions fly as quick as arrows and never pausing for an answer. "'We left King's Landing a fortnight ago,' Catelyn replied, answering the safest of his questions. "'Oh, that's where I'm bound,' the youth said. As she had suspected, he was more interested in telling his own story than hearing theirs. Singers love nothing half so well as the sound of their own voices. "'The hands tawny means rich lords with fat purses. "'The last time I came away with more silver than I could carry, or would have, "'if I hadn't lost it all betting on the King's Slayer to win the day.' "'The gods frown on the gambler,' Sir Roderick said sternly. "'He was of the North and shared the stark views on tournaments. "'They frowned on me for certain,' the singer said. "'Your cruel gods and the Knight of Flowers all together did me in.' "'No doubt there was a lesson for you,' Sir Roderick said. "'It was. This time, my coin will champion Sir Loris.' Sir Roderick tried to tug at whiskers that were not there. But before he could frame a rebuke, the serving boy came scurrying up. He laid trenchers of bread before them and filled them with chunks of browned meat off a skewer, dripping with hot juice. Another skewer held tiny onions, fire peppers, and fat mushrooms. Sir Roderick set to lustily as the lad ran back to fetch them beer. "'My name is Marillion,' the singer said, plucking a string on his wood harp. "'Doubtless you've heard me play somewhere.' His manner made Catelyn smile. Few wandering singers ever ventured as far north as Winterfell, but she knew his like from her girlhood in Riverrun. "'I fear not,' she told him. He drew a plaintive chord from his wood harp. "'That is your loss,' he said. "'Who was the finest singer you've ever heard?'
"'Elia of Braavos,'
Sir Roderick answered at once.
"'I'm much better than that old stick,' Marillion said. "'If you have the silver for a song, I'll gladly show you.'
"'I might have a copper or two, but I'd sooner toss it down a well than pay for your harling,'
Sir Roderick grasped. His opinion of singers was well known. Music was a lovely thing for girls, but he could not comprehend why any healthy boy would fill his hand with a harp when he might have had a sword. "'Your grandfather has a sour nature,' Marillion said to Catelyn. "'I meant to do you honour, an homage to your beauty. "'In truth, I was made to sing for kings and high lords.'
"'Oh, I can see that,' Catelyn said. "'Lord Tully is fond of song, I hear. "'No doubt you've been to River Run.'
"'100 times,' the singer said airily. "'They keep a chamber for me.' "'And the young lord is like a brother.'
Catelyn smiled, wondering what Edmure would think of that. Another singer had once bedded a girl her brother fancied, and he had hated the breed ever since. "'And Winterfell,' she asked him, "'have you travelled north?'
"'Why would I?' Marillion asked. "'It's all blizzards and bearskins up there, "'and the Starks know no music but the howling of wolves.'
Distantly, she was aware of the door banging open at the far end of the room.
"'Innkeep,' a servant's voice called out behind her. "'We have horses that want stabling, and my Lord of Lannister requires a room and a hot bath.'
"'Oh, gods,' Sir Roderick said, before Catelyn reached out to silence him, her fingers tightening around his forearm. Masha Heddle was bowing and smiling her hideous red smile.
"'I'm sorry, my lord, truly. We're full up, every room.'
There were four of them, Catelyn saw. An old man in the black of the night's watch, two servants, and him, standing there, small and bold as life.
"'My men will sleep in your stable, and as for myself, well, I do not require a large room, as you can plainly see.'
He flashed a mocking grin. "'So long as the fire's warm and the straw reasonably free of fleas, I am a happy man.' Masha Heddle was beside herself.
"'My lord, there's nothing. It's a tawny. There's no help for it. Oh!'
Tyrion Lannister pulled a coin from his purse and flicked it up over his head, caught it, tossed it up again. Even across the room where Catelyn sat, the wink of gold was unmistakable. A free rider in a faded blue cloak lurched to his feet.
"'You're welcome to my room, my lord.'
"Now there's a clever man," Lannister said, as he sent the coin spinning across the room. The free rider snatched it from the air. "And a nimble one to boot." The dwarf turned back to Masha Hedl. "You will be able to manage food, I trust."
"Anything you like, my lord, anything at all,"
the innkeep promised.
"And may he choke on it,"
Catelyn thought. But it was Bran she saw, choking, drowning on his own blood. Lannister glanced at the nearest tables.
"My men will have whatever you're serving these people. Double portions, we've had a long, hard ride. I'll take a roast fowl, chicken, duck, pigeon, it makes no matter. And send up a flagon of your best wine. Yaren, will you sup with me?"
"Aye, my lord, I will,"
the black brother replied. The dwarf had not so much as glanced toward the far end of the room, and Catelyn was thinking how grateful she was for the crowded benches between them, when suddenly Marillion bounded to his feet.
"My lord of Lannister," he called out, "I would be pleased to entertain you while you eat. Let me sing you the lay of your father's great victory at King's Landing."
"Nothing would be more likely to ruin my supper," the dwarf said dryly. His mismatched eyes considered the singer briefly, started to move away, and found Catelyn. He looked at her for a moment, puzzled. She turned her face away, but too late. The dwarf was smiling.
"Lady Stark, oh, what an unexpected pleasure," he said. "I was sorry to miss you at Winterfell."
Marillion gaped at her, confusion giving way to chagrin, as Catelyn rose slowly to her feet. She heard Sir Roderick curse. If only the man had lingered at the wall, she thought, if only.
"Lady Stark," Masha Hedl said thickly.
"I was still Catelyn Tully the last time I bedded here," she told the innkeeper. She could hear the muttering, feel the eyes upon her. Catelyn glanced around the room, at the faces of the knights and sworn swords, took a deep breath to slow the frantic beating of her heart. Did she dare take the risk? There was no time to think it through, only the moment and the sound of her own voice ringing in her ears. "You in the corner," she said to an older man she had not noticed until now. "Is that the black bat of Harrenhal I see embroidered on your surcoat, sir?" The man got to his feet. "It is, my lady. And his lady went a true and honest friend to my father, Lord Huster Tully of Riverrun?" "She is," the man replied stoutly. Sir Roderick rose quietly and loosened his sword in its scabbard. The dwarf was blinking at them, blank-faced, with puzzlement in his mismatched eyes. "The Red Stallion was ever a welcome sight at Riverrun," she said to the trio by the fire. "My father counts Jonas Bracken amongst his oldest and most loyal bannermen." The three men-at-arms exchanged uncertain looks. "Our lord is honoured by his trust," one of them said hesitantly. "I envy your father all these fine friends," Lannister quipped, "but I do not quite see the purpose of this, Lady Stark." She ignored him, turning to the large party in blue and grey. They were the heart of the matter. There were more than 20 of them. "I know your sigil as well, the Twin Towers of Frey. How fares your good lord, sirs?" Their captain rose.
"Lord Walder is well, my lady. He promises to take a new wife on his 90th name day and has asked your lord father to honour the wedding with his presence."
Tyrion Lannister sniggered. That was when Catelyn knew he was hers. "This man came as a guest into my house and there conspired to murder my son, a boy of 7, she proclaimed to the room at large, pointing. Sir Roderick moved to her side, his sword in hand. "In the name of King Robert and the good lords you serve, I call upon you to seize him and help me return him to Winterfell to await the king's justice." She did not know what was a more satisfying.
the sound of a dozen swords drawn as one, or the look on Tyrion Lannister's face.
Circe. It was a slow climb to the top of Visenya's hill. As the horses labored upward, the queen leaned back against a plump red cushion. From outside came the voice of Sir Osmond Kettleblack.
"Make way! Clear the streets! Make way for Her Grace the Queen!"
"Marjorie does keep a lively court," Lady Merriweather was saying. "We have jugglers, mummers, poets, puppets." "Singers?" prompted Circe. "Many and more, Your Grace. Hamish the Harper plays for her once a fortnight, and sometimes Alaric of Isen will entertain us of an evening, but the Blue Bard is her favorite." Circe recalled the bard from Tommen's wedding. Young and fair to look upon. Could there be something there? "There are other men as well, I hear. Knights and courtiers, admirers. Tell me true, my lady. Do you think Marjorie is high garden? I helped disrobe him for the bedding. His lordship was a well-made man and lusty. I saw the proof when we tumbled him into the wedding bed, where his bride awaited him as naked as her name day, blushing prettily beneath the coverlets. Sir Loras had carried her up the steps himself." "Marjorie may say that the marriage was never consummated, that Lord Renly had drunk too much wine at the wedding feast, but I promise you, the bit between his legs was anything but weary when last I saw it." "Did you chance to see the marriage bed the morning after?" Circe asked. "Did she bleed?"
"No sheet was shown, Your Grace."
"A pity." Still, the absence of a bloody sheet meant little by itself. Common peasant girls bled like pigs upon their wedding nights, she had heard, but that was less true of high-born maids like Marjorie Tyrell. A lord's daughter was more like to give her maidenhead to a horse than a husband, it was said, and Marjorie had been riding since she was old enough to walk. "I understand the little queen has many admirers among our household knights. The Redwine twins, Sir Tallard. Who else, pray tell?" Lady Merriweather gave a shrug. "Sir Lambert, the fool who hides a good eye behind a patch. Bayard Norcross, Courtney Greenhill, the brothers Woodwright, sometimes Portifer, and often Lucantine. Oh, and Grand Maester Pycelle is a frequent visitor." "Pycelle? Truly? Had that doddering old worm forsaken the lion for the rose? If so, he will regret it. Who else?" "The Summer Islander in his feathered cloak. How could I have forgotten him with his skin as black as ink? Others come to pay court to her cousins. Eleanor is promised to the Ambrose boy, but loves to flirt. And Mega has a new suitor every fortnight. Once she kissed a potboy in the kitchen. I have heard talk of her marrying Lady Bulwer's brother, but if Mega were to choose for herself, she would sooner have Mark Mullendore, I am certain." Circe laughed. "The butterfly knight who lost his arm on the Blackwater? What good is half a man? Mega thinks him sweet. She has asked Lady Marjorie to help her find a monkey for him." "A monkey?" The queen did not know what to say to that. "Sparrows and monkeys. Truly the realm is going mad. What of our brave Sir Loras? How often does he call upon his sister? More than any of the others." When Taina frowned, a tiny crease appeared between her dark eyes. "Every morn and every night he visits, unless duty interferes. Her brother is devoted to her. They share everything with..." "Oh!" For a moment the Mearish woman looked almost shocked. Then a smile spread across her face. "I have had a most wicked thought, Your Grace." "Best keep it to yourself. The hill is thick with sparrows, and we all know how sparrows abhor wickedness. I have heard they abhor soap and water too, Your Grace. Perhaps too much prayer robs a man of his sense of smell. I shall be sure to ask His High Holiness." The drapery swayed back and forth in a wash of crimson silk. "Orton told me that the High Septon has no name," Lady Taina said. "Can that be true? In Mere, we all have names." "Oh, he had a name once. They all do. The queen waved a hand dismissively. Even septons born of noble blood go only by their given names once they have taken their vows. When one of them is elevated to high septon, he puts aside that name as well. The faith will tell you he no longer